Welcome to Saturday Night at the Movies, the podcast that celebrates classic, cult, and current films and the people that made them and many other aspects of pop culture. I'm your host, Steve Rubin. Our producer is Ben Shrewsbury, and our signature theme was composed by Greg Lehrhoff. Here it's always Saturday night, and our mission is to chronicle film and pop cultural history one memory at a time. Tonight, we welcome multi-award-winning filmmaker David Lee Miller, an author, artist, social scientist, and Fulbright grantee, Alessandra Seggi, to discuss how suicide has been portrayed in American film. David and I produced the feature film My Suicide, which has been an evergreen for Netflix, won 20 international Best Picture Awards, including Berlinale, and which Alessandra covers with a chapter in her exquisitely researched book, Youth and Suicide in American Cinema, Context, Causes, and Consequences. Welcome, Alessandra.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome, David.
Thank you very much for having me, too.
So the first question I'm going to ask both of you, ladies first, is when you were a little girl and you were going to the movies for the first time, where was that specifically?
Okay. It was the main town, half an hour from the village I'm from, Hicksville, Italy. No, the name is different, but a small village in Italy. And we would go to the main town being Genoa or Genova in Italian. And so that was the big city. Little did I know that, you know, half a million people are nothing when then you cross the ocean and you go to grad school in New York City, where, you know, 8 million people are nothing. But so, yes, that was the movie theater. What I recall sort of in the big city, what I recall is I have an exquisite intolerance for anything that is not cotton. So I remember complaining about the seats that were sort of scratchy. That's not so much cinematographic, but more tactile. But that's my first memory. And it was, alas, one of the Disney movies.
And do you remember which Disney movie it was?
I think it was 101 Dalmatians and stuff.
Ah, obviously in Italian with subtitles.
Dubbed.
Dubbed.
That's why Italians speak like this when they speak in English, because they don't absorb American or anyway foreign movies with the actual actors' voices. Everything is dubbed. So De Niro, DiCaprio, Di Bartolomeo, who's not an actor yet that I know of, they all sound the same, because sadly they're probably dubbed by the same handful of people. So
that's hilarious.
Were your parents
of 101 Dalmatians, though? What a great movie.
Oh, yeah. Were your parents, did your parents like movies too? Did they come with you, or were you? No,
I mean, in that case I was small enough that they did, but my sort of visual propensity, I'm not sure. I'm not trying to start a fight with my folks, they know it, but I am not. Although I am genetically related to that, to them, I have not taken any liking from them. So my visual propensity is absolutely all my own. So they're not very visual.
Got it.
They're very
Got it.
Tactile, both of them.
So David, I assume that things began for you in lovely Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
That's right, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And what was your theater of choice as a little boy?
It was the Fox Bay Theater. It was the local theater where you could go for 25 cents and enjoy a matinee. Curiously, the same theater that the Zucker Brothers would premiere all of their movies at later, because it was this theater that they grew up with too.
And do you remember some of your first favorite films?
101 Dalmatians was definitely one of them. loved Cruella de Vil. Yeah.
Cruella de Vil.
Because you know the old saying, an animated film is only as good as its bad guy.
So true. So
yeah.
True. I like that purple in, right? Isn't she purple a little bit?
All I remember was she was smoking, and I
very colorful, purple,
and it's
reds, you know,
and
like.
the smoke. She was smoking all the time, and that cigarette holder of hers. I hated smoking growing up so voraciously that when I went to UCLA as a junior, I did an editorial in the Daily Bruin about how much I hate smoking, and they published it. All right, so we are talking about a very serious subject. Let me get out of the way of this title: Youth and Suicide in American Cinema. So I'll start with you, Alessandra. How, and there's the book. How on earth did you come upon this very serious but important topic?
Good question, and it's also a sad question. In the sense that the place I come from has seen it's more than a handful of suicides. And so before any schooling, as in grad school, before learning that sociology, and I'm happy to talk about it more, is actually founded, was legitimized with a study on suicide, before learning any of that, I had my first grade teacher that unfortunately killed herself. And of course, at age six, I wasn't told that she had killed herself. I was told she wasn't doing well and she eventually passed away. Years later, I found out, I was told, right, protecting children, vulnerable people. I was later told she, in fact, did not die of other causes. She died by suicide. And in the in between, I think I was a late teenager at that point. But after that first, so to speak, encounter, blunt, that teacher, I still remember her name, extremely talented. But to a 6-year-old, she was middle-aged. She was very stern and ominous. And understanding later, better understanding, learning later that she had killed herself, I always wondered what was up with her, what was going on in her life. But since, like I said, a series of other suicides in my town, many by suicides of many individuals that if they weren't literally my friends, they were people I knew, acquaintances in the village. And we discussed, right, at some point I left Italy, and the suicides have continued. And so that was the sort of the original impetus, something that definitely, for better or worse, has shaped me as a person, understanding that somebody today is here and somebody and that somebody the day after is not there, whether or not there are the so-called warning signs.
Got it, got it.
That's sort of one piece of how I got into this topic. The other piece is I was mentioning in grad school, first I received an MA in media studies because of my visual propensity and so my interest in film. And from the master's, then I pursued a PhD in sociology, very much focused on sociology of media. And so at that point, being introduced to the discipline of sociology, I found out that wouldn't you know that sociology as a discipline in the 19th century was legitimized precisely with a study on people killing themselves. 1897, Le Suicide in French, suicide in English. Emile Durkheim was trying to say, folks, understanding things according to what sociology does is extremely important. I'm going to pick this one reality, complex as all get out, that we call people killing themselves. And instead of using philosophy, psychology, the established disciplines at the time, I'm going to show you that if we use the tools, the tricks of sociology to understand suicide, we're going to be completely flabbergasted by the knowledge, by the richness of what we can learn. So that is at a time, again, 19th century, when sociology wasn't quite considered, like I said, a legit academic discipline. If we go across the US, we might, you know, this days, we might, yes, that sociology, understanding, sociology that was a discipline that wasn't quite considered, you know, full-fledged legit, and was struggling and competing literally against departments of psychology and or philosophy, you know, was literally legitimized by this study by Durkheim, 1897, saying, I'm going to pick the most individual, the most antisocial, if you want, to some extent, but not always, actually, he demonstrated. I'm going to pick this very, you know, individual way of behaving, killing oneself, and I'm going to study it from the outside in. And I'm going to show you guys, everybody, how important that study is to understand suicide and so understand social life. And so the gist of it, you stop me anytime because I can go off and speak.
Oh, no, no. I'm actually going to switch over to David for a second.
Because yeah.
David, as the filmmaker of My Suicide, it all started with some phenomenon that was happening in your neck of the woods in Thousand Oaks, Westlake Village. Can you talk a little bit about what was happening out there before you decided to make a movie?
Yeah, and what happened was there was a car accident, car crash in our neighborhood where four, you know, good kids in a truck hit the wall at 105 miles an hour. And, you know, my son, Jordan, was making a lot of movies, showing them at X Dance, at Sundance. You know, he was kind of a freaky little 14-year-old who was really good at making movies. And he had done a public service announcement, for lack of a better word, about the crash. And it came to the attention of the city of Thousand Oaks, and they gave him a grant to start to make more PSAs. And we had talked about putting together a media group that was by youth for youth, where young people would make really powerful media that would get professional distribution to try to make a difference. And we started tackling car crashes. And as we were tackling car crashes, which is considered the number one killer of our teenagers, we discovered that about a third of car crashes are single vehicle, single driver. And sometimes the kid will leave a suicide note before. And it really, we started to believe, as we delved deeper into the topic, that suicide was the number one killer of kids, especially since there's a taboo surrounding it and people don't report suicides a lot. So we started tackling suicide. And as we were doing it, and, you know, really was a team effort, it was my son Jordan and my daughter Sarah and a whole group of really talented young kids who really cared. We all felt that making a movie about it would be a much more impactful way to reach more people than some kind of pedantic public service announcement. And that movie should have an authentic youth voice, because suicide amongst young people was going up in numbers, which it still is, by the way. People are fighting the good fight, but everything is skewing younger because there's so much information out there for kids who are, you know, possibly growing up before they need to, whatever it is. I mean, whether it's a part of it is the pandemic, and that's become part of our mental health crisis, but it's still happening. Suicide is skewing younger and younger. That said, the whole crew, including you, because you were, my first part Hollywood partner and producer on trying to get this movie together, and you were unbelievably essential to that happening. I'm not sure where I was going with that.
Well, but, the fact that you had youth making public service announcements was rather revolutionary at the time, because I think a lot of PSAs are conceived of by adults who are basically looking down at the kids saying, this is how you should act. And here are young people coming up with their own ideas. I mean, we kind of have this cliche of the MTV generation with no attention span, but I think it's clear that each generation has its own language to help communicate to its peer group. And I think with your kids, David, you were able to be in that period. And I've always thought of you as a perpetual teenager anyway.
Yeah. My literary sensibilities are that of a, I don't know, 14-year-old girl, maybe. It's like, I've never grown up, and I love YA literature. So, you know, we started tackling kind of the subject of suicide. We just went into, like, you know, deep research, you know, which Alessandra, in your book, you noticed that, you know, I mean, we really were well researched, and you know, there's a lot of controversy around how to deal with suicide. You know, there's some groups that we encountered that felt like you shouldn't talk about it. They called it the S word, and they thought any mention of the S word would cause a rise in suicide. Well, everything that we researched said that that's absolutely not true, and that shattering the taboo and communication, and that a suicidal person who realizes that they're not alone in their pain, and articulates it, is a positive, you know, usually positive direction in getting healthier. That's how we came up with the project.
In reading your book, Alessandra, I was surprised at the number of films that cover an aspect of suicide. I mean, you referenced literally hundreds of movies. I want to start putting up some stills of some pictures, which I wouldn't normally think would get me thinking suicide. But the first one I will put up is a movie that we all know, and let's see, there we go.
Can we guess? It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life. Yes.
I mean, It's a Wonderful Life is about the most popular movie in American history, perhaps next to The Wizard of Oz. And I obviously remember that George Bailey is ready to jump off a bridge and end it. But how impactful was that storyline for you in your study?
Well, the idea was that I was trying to look at movies targeting youth, however broadly or however complicated that definition or that target audience might be. And so then my elaboration of movies by youth, see My Suicide, Archie's Final Project, movies for youth or movies about youth. But anyway, I tried my best to get my hands, my eyeballs, and my lenses or contact lenses on as many movies that had that by, for, and about youth, and then a suicide, whether directly of a young person or in the movie, and how did that impact. So to your question, having offered this little preface, It's a Wonderful Life strikes me as a movie that, right, like we said, it's a Christmas movie. It's about, as the title tells us, hey, it's beautiful, right? So almost not don't complain, but focus on that. Although there are undercurrents, right, of complaints or not, that as I bring up in the book, right, that that are not voiced, right? That are not necessarily dealt with, like all the sacrifices, right, that this young man does for the sake of others. So it is indeed a Christmas movie, right, in the sense that let's be altruistic, right? Let's be for other people, right? He gives up his traveling the world, his dreams of becoming an architect. He picks up the family business right when the father dies suddenly, so the brother can go off and do his thing. So it's a wonderful life, but I have sacrificed a lot, right? The James Stewart character says, so sort of says or acts like. So, but all of that, and so here's again the connection to Christianity, right? Makes sense because we are being Christian. We are living, so to speak, for other people. But whether or not that, like you said, Steve, he's about to jump, right? Whether or not this is a, right, sort of a fantasy tale or not, we see this man, right, in flesh and bone, about to jump because he's figured out I'm worthier when I'm dead than alive, right? Then because of the insurance policy. So here, Christianity, right? Catholicism, definitely at the time, we're speaking 1946, right? Suicide is not sanctioned. That says, I'm going to die. I am, right, going to be my own killer, right? That's what suicide means, literally from the Greek root. I am going to die to save others. So that's what, so to speak, I believe, I wouldn't say it's a new reading, but that's what I believe, and correct me, Steve, if I'm not answering your question, that's what I believe I bring out about this sort of Christmas classic.
Sure, and interestingly, the movie was not a success. It was, in fact,
yes.
Yeah, Liberty Pictures, which was the company that Frank Capra formed with two other directors, was going to be a big entity in Hollywood, but this movie lost a lot of money and the company soon went under, so it was not a success. Let me pull up another film, which it takes place about a decade later.
Sorry, Steve, can I add something?
But of course.
Thank you, because I think it's both ironic and interesting. It became a classic once it was broadcast on TV. And then sort of like right as a filler, and then it's just like, oh, so now we have this thing that sort of more of the memory of what it was not right back then, but as something.
Sure. I think another factor was post-war audiences, I think, were not entirely comfortable with the travail that Jimmy's character, George Bailey, had to go through. I mean, post-war audiences wanted something light and frothy. In fact, World War II movies, which were such a mainstay throughout the war, they stopped being produced for about 3.5 years until mid-49. So that also had effect on it. But let me put up another shot here, another iconic film, which definitely had an impact at the time, which of course is Rebel Without a Cause. Tell me how this impacted your research.
Well, I think this movie is I read it as really the essence of what we say in French, not to use an English word, ennui, right? The sense of listlessness, of not knowing if we're coming, if we're going, teenage, adolescent angst, right? And so the James Dean character and his rival, why are we doing this chicken run? Well, I don't know. We gotta do something, right? And so that as sort of the quintessential symbol of, so we're going to, right, run towards a drop off, a cliff, and the one that does jump off is the chicken. So, right, masculinity, as I put it, right, is better dead than alive. And
I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. You said that the one who jumps off the cliff is the chicken. Isn't it the one who doesn't jump off the cliff is the chicken, or am I mistaken?
Well, no, the brave guy is the one that waits, meaning in the race, right? The ones that jumps first is the chicken, right?
I see.
Right? And so if you wait and wait and wait, risking, right, to fall off the cliff, then you're really a man in, right, in the heads of these young people. And so hence, right, my saying, well, then dead masculinity, right, is superior, so to speak, to actually being a young person and alive. And so that as sort of a, right, pretzel logic type reasoning, right? Not really sound reasoning. And so the title to me, and I tie it then to the second part of the movie, Rebel Without a Cause, as in, right, we are rebelling, we are running ourselves to death off the cliff because, right, we have this angst and we don't know how to express it. And the James Dean character, right, Jim says, well, he has a very conflicted relationship with his parents, his father in particular, right, that doesn't seem to stand up when he needs to. Will you stand up for me, Dad? When will you do that, right? And the Jim is almost wiser than the father, right? When the rival does die and he wants to report it to the authorities, he says, don't nobody's gonna thank you for doing that. Well, what about what I have inside? But so throughout the movie, then it does, right? The Jim character grows sort of ethically, morally, I would say, into like, here is something that I think is worth fighting for.
Dave, how do you think 21st century teenagers would relate to that kind of dichotomy in Rebel Without a Cause? Do you think it's familiar to them, or is it from another planet?
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, the title itself, I think, sounds judgmental, you know. It's a little belittling, right? You know, just within its own title. I mean, it's a terrific movie. You know, it's interesting. My Suicide has so many odes to different movies because it's about a media obsessed, super talented young filmmaker, you know, who's, you know, kind of imposing things onto the world. I don't think this movie was kind of within the purview of the character or my crew. And it's weird to say from a movie that's so, you know, collects so many different movies and the, you know, Gabriel Sunday brilliantly recreates them and portrays them, you know, with his incredible voices. There's not a lot of movies that was affecting us. We weren't really imitating any movies or feeling inspired by any movies. I mean, there were some of Harold and Maude kind of, you know, was interesting. Yeah, you know, certainly to us because it was something that had seriousness to it, but also comedy, you know, and hope. Natural Born Killers appealed to us because they mixed a lot of formats, and it had this editing style that really spoke to us and our group. But beyond that, we were trying to do something new,
Yeah. And for the viewers and listeners who are on our show today listening, My Suicide, which is currently on Netflix, is a very, very powerful dramedy. And I think the dramedy aspects, as David points out, comedy can have a positive effect in helping to tell the story and entertain. It's hard to say that a suicide movie is entertaining, but I think it's critical to keep the young people's attention so that they don't think they're watching a docudrama or a documentary. David, the original concept for My Suicide, correct me if I'm wrong, you originally thought you were going to do a doc.
Yes, we always talked about doing a movie where a kid says he's going to kill himself for his fourth period, class project, and it becomes like what he goes through. But we were also, because it was coming out of a nonprofit that, was dedicating itself more and more every day to fighting teen suicide, we did shoot a lot of documentary footage, for potential public service announcements, whatever they may be. But what we were really interested in doing was imposing our story and fictitious characters onto the real world. Other people did it later. Borat kind of does it. There's other movies that we're not the first ones who had done that. But the very first thing we shot, which I think you were on, was Dr. Edwin Schneidman,
Yeah,
who is
talk a little bit
father
of yeah, talk a little bit
suicide.
about talk a little bit about Edwin Schneidman. Why did you dis why did we decide to go to Edwin Schneidman?
Well, we researched, like we were just talking about, different avenues of how do you combat suicide, and this led us very quickly to Dr. Elaine Leder, who founded Teen Line at Cedar. They were based out of Cedars-Sinai in Beverly Hills, but they had a teen line where if a suicidal kid called up or troubled by other things, they would get a teenager on the line who had 65 hours of training and professionals behind them in the room, to help them, have another kid to talk to when they were in trouble. And Dr. Elaine Leder was a magnificent person who became our mentor, our main mentor. And we started working with Teen Line and helping out in any way we can. And they used our media skills, a lot. And Elaine, kind of introduced us to the different schools of thought. And the one that spoke the most to all of us, including her, was Edwin Schneidman and suicidology. And he was the father of suicidology. And he was quite old by this time. And he was so hip. I mean, just, and the funniest thing, he would say, if, he had spent this entire career studying the darker side of life and death. And if he had, because his job was suicide. And if he had it to do all over again, he said he would study love, the thing that makes the world go round.
Tell our viewers what his reaction to the screenplay was.
Well, when he heard about our project, he just flipped out and he said he thought it was the most exciting film or media project about suicide that he had ever encountered. And he immediately agreed for us to come over to his house with Gabriel Sunday, who's pictured behind you there, playing Archie, and letting Archie let interviewing him, seeing him as a patient, effectively. And we created this little piece, and Archie was shooting him on video while he was being, analyzed. And the repartee was unbelievable, and the little piece was just this brilliant little piece that gave you hope, and taught you certain things, like so many things. Because, that moment of suicide, if you can get past that moment of suicide, chances are that's all it's going to be. And Schneidman had a famous thing he would say, you either have to discharge the emotion or discharge the bullet. So if
Wow.
you manage to discharge the emotion, you might never attempt again. It's that moment that's so important.
Look.
So, and that was something that, as you remember, we would use in our presentations to raise money from investors.
Sure.
We would show that little video of Schneidman that we shot before we had any money raised. And Alessandra, Steve was my partner from the beginning, and he raised the first $50,000 that we started making the movie with. We just started going into production with almost no money. And he raised it from a therapist, or was she a psychiatrist?
She was a therapist in Florida. Let me jump in for a second. And this is one movie I remember vividly from the 60s. Now we're now into the 60s with Sidney Poitier and Bancroft. I always thought this was a, I frankly, I had no knowledge of suicide whatsoever. And if I think the Slender Thread, do you know this movie, Dave?
I don't. I
Yeah,
just
this is kind of almost documentary-like, although it's a narrative feature about how a teen line or a suicide line person deals with a suicidal person, because Sidney Poitier, as I recall, is working the line that night and he gets a call from Anne Bancroft. What can you tell us about this movie, Alessandra?
Yeah, so this is a young Sidney Poitier is a college kid that happens to work the line overnight, and he gets there, he has of course work to do for school, and so he sets up and he's ready to get working on his stuff. But instead, this woman, on the phone, that so again, there's a lot, basically her participation and Bancroft is mostly with the voice and a very effective, powerful voice, although there are some flashbacks and things, but and it's this woman calling, in pain, again to Dave's point before about Schneidman, release the pain or release the bullet. And so and the movie is an unfiltered, not necessarily 100% representative, but it is a look, a window into the repercussions of somebody's feeling suicidal ideation. And then at some point she says, I've swallowed, this, that, the other thing. So I'm, alas, on my way to dying. And so we follow the repercussions of this decision, violence against the self with the intent to die, that's sort of the textbook definition of suicide. And we see the repercussions on this young college kid, who of course is going to be not just devastated because he's too busy trying to save her in a way, luckily for him, but that he's inevitably going to be changed. And then the main, this young person's boss, the psychiatrist in charge, and all the people around the city. She does not reveal where she's at. And so they cannot locate her, and they cannot, go there and try to save her. And so it's a sort of a story that starts sort of, in this set, movie set of this office when the phone rings. And then it opens up to literally the entire city and people coming and going, police, the phone company, we're not speaking cell phones, and ways of tracing people were much more long-winded in order, a hundreds of people or tens of people at least trying to save her. And this is not to say, oh wow, look at the waste. No. In Schneidman's actually thinking, look at how much pain, this woman must have been to say and to do what she did. And so look at the repercussions. One comment to the adult, sorry, young adult novel, not the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why, but the novel. There's a comment on the author's website that says, suicide does not end the pain. It passes it on, as in more people get involved and suffer the consequences of that original pain.
Now,
Yes.
we all grew up in an era where the telephone was a major form of communication. I mean, it obviously going back to dial telephones and then
Right.
into cell phones. Young people today don't seem to use phones as phones. They use them as texting devices. Let me ask a question to either of you. Maybe you don't know the answer, but helplines, teen lines, suicide prevention lines, do young people call into them still?
Well, they've adapted. Teen Line did that. So you can text, you can email, you can voice chat, you can, FaceTime. They'll accept any way you want to reach them.
Yes, absolutely. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, that's
And
good. Because those
Elaine, Elaine, who was, into her 90s when we were still working with her, she was very hip to that, very.
sure. Okay, let's move on here. This was a very popular film, I think late 80s. Heathers.
Others.
Alessandra, tell us why you chose this film to mention today.
I was trying to strike a balance between sort of things that I think are meaningful in the way that they tackle suicide or suicidality, and movies that, of course, have something to say about suicide and meaningful too, but they're not necessarily centered around suicide, or they're not a representative, sort of necessarily realistic take on suicide. And so Heathers, that comes at the end of the 80s, right? 1989, could be counterposed to The Breakfast Club from 1985, 4 years before. I can't do this highfalutin math all in the under pressure. No, just kidding. But Heathers has been considered, so where The Breakfast Club has, right, this group of people in detention, right, that represent again the sort of the typical, the stereotypical, the jock, the brain, et cetera, in high school. Heathers is sort of the quintessential over-the-top exaggeration of everything that high school may represent. Timothée Sherry, who is the scholar on youth cinema in America, considers Heathers, together with Pump Up the Volume, sort of same period, as sort of revisionist movies, films, youth movies, as in, yes, they say something. Of course, right? Everything does say something, but it's sort of in an exaggerated way that we are making a statement. And so, as I mentioned, Heather, it's sort of an exaggeration of bullying, of cliques in high school, of again, the sense of angst, the sense of feeling, not in a good place, of not knowing who one is. And so we go from delinquency, criminal activity, unkindness, the more the merrier. And so in that mix, then we have suicide attempts, actual suicides, murders disguised as suicides, as in fake suicides. And so it's really, again, a sort of an exaggeration of many of the themes that sort of come up, are stirred up at a young age, say in high school or in high school in America, whatever, right, that might be.
Tell us about this film.
I don't see it. Yes. That's Beyond the Lights, 2014. One of the few, not few, yes, one of the few films that it was actually directed by a woman. And of course, has some elements of suicidality. The idea here is that, yes, suicidality might happen. One might feel suicidal. But as David was saying before, if we tackle, right, if we deal with those emotions, the pain in particular, right, then hopefully not just we can move on and not be dead, but we can have a fulfilling, a good life. And so this movie is particularly interesting because as it discusses help, seeking it, as I call it in the book, offering it and then being willing to receive it, it shows a variety of positions in those in regard to those sort of aspects of help seeking, offering, and receiving it. And so the woman, you know, hugged by the man here in the picture is a young musician that feels the pressure of, you know, what it means to be a musician. Okay, at this point it's 10 years old, but, you know, still, you know, a competitive, objectifying, possibly sexualizing type of music scene and music world, music market. So she attempts suicide at this young man who happened to be the police escort in charge of her, saves her as she is about to jump off the railing in her hotel apartment.
I think so, in the book you point out that this is one of the few films of diversity that deals with the suicide.
Yes. Now, also, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Because indeed, as we know, right, film, although of course we definitely as here, right, we have sort of good things that we want to communicate with movies, but movies is also is a business, right? And so sometimes, right, movies tend to portray demographics that then don't necessarily jibe with the demographics that are affected the most by suicide or suicidality more in general. And so although minorities such as African Americans, Blacks in America, Latinos, etc., may not be portrayed often, right, in movies and youth movies in particular, alas, Black First Nation people have the highest suicide rate as far as youth is concerned. And so this movie, although it's actually set in the UK, but it is an American movie, right, does give ultimately a good story, as in not feel good, as in everything is pink and pink elephants, but we are in trouble. This young woman does feel suicidal, does attempt suicide, but help is possible. And with help comes hope. And so it's a story where different characters, indeed, the music industry is absolutely not interested. We sell dreams. Suicide is not cool. They are that blunt. The mother has her own self-interest and sort of past regrets and wants the daughter to succeed. Tell me that it was a mistake. But she's not waiting for the daughter to express herself. And
Dave, you mentioned how My Suicide got off the ground. Why don't you describe for the people who don't know the film who Archie is?
Archie is a teenager. He's overconnected. He's disconnected, like so many of so many teenagers today. But he's also a supremely talented media maker and filmmaker. And he's really feeling isolated. And he announces for his fourth period video production class that he's going to kill himself on camera. And that triggers a response from the school, from peers, from the community, from his family, that, you know, even includes 72 hours of observation. And it's a way for us to, you know, have a lens into that world of youth suicide and keep the voice authentic, you know, really coming from kids. So the suicide is really like the MacGuffin of the movie. The movie actually becomes a journey from narcissism to connection, which, you know, is ultimately becomes hopeful. And I mean, it's been an incredible ride We premiered the movie in Berlin and won the Crystal Bear for Best Picture, and that kind of got us all over the world with the picture. So, you know, at this point, cutting, you know, however many years later it is, it's almost 15 now. We've just had thousands of testimonials of kids who it's pulled back from the ledge, families. I mean, we kind of knew it was coming when we were making the movie, because we would test the movie. And we had an early test where 40 some kids watched it in a living room, you know, a rough cut. And after the screening, one of those kids pulled his suicide note out of a trash can and showed it to his dad. And it started a whole communication. The dad had no idea what his kid was going through. And, you know, I played pickleball with that kid just the other day, you know, like, I mean, it really worked. And Netflix has been amazing. You know, there was a film festival called Gen Art that Ted Sarandos was the head of the jury. And we kind of won everything at Gen Art. And then they invited us to be the corporate retreat movie that year with the Sundance winner, which was called We Live in Public by Andy Timoner. It became like a sister film too. We did started doing events together because it was about living, how everybody's living in public online. It was an experiment around that, and you know, and there were certain, there's parallels between our two movies. But they've been amazing at Netflix because they kind of realize that the film is performing its mission that came out of this teen suicide prevention program they keep showing it. And every time that it's time to, like, well, should we, you know, keep it going? And, you know, you peek into whatever the social media might be of that time, whether it's Tumblr, you know, now it's kind of a Letterboxd and TikTok, of course. You know, for example, in November of 2022, all of a sudden there was a massive spike on TikTok. I don't go on TikTok or do a lot of social media, but I have my spies out there, and they're like, "Wow, we're getting hundreds of thousands, even millions of views." And you know, there's this new aesthetic on TikTok called corecore, and Archie is considered like OG corecore. You know, corecore is about taking media out there and mashing it up and re-editing it and repurposing it, and you know, whether you're trying to show something beautiful or angry or whatever it might be. And you know, Archie, and frankly my daughter Sarah before Archie, was doing that back in the day. You know, they're corecore. So whenever it's time to look at it, what's going on again, there's all these reviews posted that day. You know, oh, it's my favorite movie of all time, this movie saved my life. I mean, they're that direct about how they're commenting on the movie. And then we have been surprised also as to how many repeat viewers we get. You know, there's people who've told us that they've seen it 30 times. And that's pretty typical.
Let me jump in here and ask Alessandra. You refer to the movie in your book. You devote a whole chapter to it. You call it a game changer. Why is it a game changer?
Well, in a lot of ways, I would start with one aspect that I was going to use from what David just said, the idea of it being a movie that, yes, speaks about suicide, but suicide is the MacGuffin to speak about broader issues, broader things. And so it's about moving from narcissism to connection. And so it's a game changer in its elegance, for instance. And so in the way, for instance, again, the movie uses then violence, again, at the core of suicide, violence against the self, self-violence. But in this case, when Archie, close to the end of the movie, goes to Vargas, right, the death poet of LA, one of, right, the many people that indeed he's able to connect to, and he says, don't kill yourself, kill the part of you that you don't like, right? Because that's what's gonna make you crawl up and die. And so sort of this, not just beautiful, but for good, for a good cause, use if we want a violence to say, let's get rid of this stuff that is not doing us any good, and then let's move on. So yes, so starting from there, it's a game changer in terms of, for instance, what we already discussed that David explained before about how many layers of media it has, so to speak, inside and out, right? All the innovative ways of using media, mixing, again, what looks like high eight videos from the birthdays to Archie's present filming and footage to documentary footage, right, of Edwin Schneidman literally saying, right, like you said, David, release the pain or the bullet, right? So it's either or. And indeed, and more tragically about the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, right, the debate for decades about whether or not to put a barrier, right, and they finally did. But the resistance, those that resisted the barrier, were always saying, ah, it's going to sort of, you know, spoil the beauty of the bridge, and it's useless. Because if you want to kill yourself, you're going to do it. No. Yep. As, you know, David was saying, that impulse literally to jump literally from that bridge, right? Once we move away from there, again, literally or metaphorically pulled back from the edge, we can regain
our
equilibrium, right? It may not take a second, right? Or right, or a credit card purchase, but it's possible.
And it's
right, and it's a common misconception.
Common thing. If it was harder to get a gun, it would reduce the
suicide.
Because if you eat pills, what is it, 3% chance you're going to die if you eat pills thinking you're killing yourself with pills? But with a gun, it's 90%.
Absolutely.
So a lot of those people who ate pills and survived, they're like, oh my God, I can't believe I did that. And they'll go on a journey to healing. Not all of them.
Absolutely.
David, what Alessandra says about Vargas is very interesting, because what Vargas says, that statement about if you're going to kill yourself, go ahead and do it, but kill the side of you you don't like so you can get up in the morning.
It's all about you.
Where did that come from? Where do you think the influence for what could be a rather revolutionary statement?
Well, the dialogue came from Eric Adams, who is my brilliant co-writer and producer on this picture. He'd been working with young people. It's part of his young work with young people. And that was, the message of, various people. So, and curiously, that is the most shared and repeated dialogue out there from the movie. I mean, when Tumblr was around, there were some shares of that were up in the, like in a million shares. I think even Britney Spears shared it once.
By the way, Alessandra, I was part of the group that suggested to David and Eric that they do not release the movie under the title My Suicide. That's how we became Archie's final project at Berlin. And in retrospect, I was wrong. It should have always been called My Suicide. But I was thinking like a marketeer, thinking that the word suicide is a negative. In your work, in isolating and analyzing all these movies, do you think the word suicide in a title is a negative?
Well, it could be, but I think, of course, right, aside from trends or right marketing, so to speak, strategies and sort of cultural trends like, we can't use, right, the S word or the F word, right? So, but I think it, and that's what actually I'm arguing when I, in an article that hopefully it's going to come out soon about the posters, that use either My Suicide or Archie's Final Project. Saying Archie's Final Project, not using My Suicide, really diminishes the power of just from the get-go of what the viewer, the reader, the thinker can like, wait, is it me speaking from the dead? Is it my suicide gone wrong? Right? And this is actually from the original, one of the original producers, right? Dave, Larry Janz, that I had also interviewed, and part of his interview I included in my book. That was a statement, sort of a couple of statements, right, in relation to my suicide as a title, that really makes you stop and say, wait a minute, okay. So as of right now, I would say, it's not a problem. Then 15 years ago, possibly might have been, or more of a problem.
Sure, no, of
And
course. I mean,
then,
it
right?
was interesting when we, in Berlin, how the rest of the world deals with it. It wouldn't have been a big problem with the rest of the world. I mean, Jofoni, it premiered
Wow, yes.
in a program that was all about taboo. I mean, we weren't even the edgiest picture, which we always usually were. But in Berlin, when the catalog came out, we were all excited and we got it. And the very first line of the catalog said, "Archie makes mind fucks." And we were like, "Wow, that's really great. That will never happen in North America. That'll never happen in the United States. They will never show that level of respect to young people, and talk, let them talk in their language." But in Berlin, it was first line,
Well, this has been very enjoyable. I know that we could probably do another hour, and in fact, I'm already going to suggest that the three of us get together down the road again for another discussion, because suicide is not going away. It's still a terrible virus, and I think that I'm so proud to have been involved with my suicide as a film, because as David points out, it's saving lives, and thanks to Netflix, it's staying on the air for the world to see. Alessandra, tell people how they can find your book.
My book is online on the publisher's website, which is the publisher, the imprint is Palgrave Macmillan, but the publisher website is Springer Link. And it's available in hard copy, soft cover, digital. And there are some Google previews also available on the publisher's website, Springer Link. There is the whole preface. The intro, the appendix is all available.
And
But
if someone wants to reach out to you, what is the best way to reach out to you?
it's my first name, I would say email, so can I share my,
Of course.
yeah, it's my first name, alessandra.seggi at my academic home, which is villanova.edu.
Excellent.
And if I may add, I mean, it's clear to your audience that I, or maybe not, but I mean, I am a big fan of Archie's final project, My Suicide. I think it brings a lot. And what I wanted to say is that I think I didn't get a chance to discuss all the ways in which Archie's is a game changer. And so
So we're going to have to probably do a part two,
that's it.
definitely.
Absolutely.
Definitely. And David, you and I are working on a number of projects together. Tell them a little bit about Mushi.
Well, we have a book out called The Cat Who Lived with Anne Frank. And it's a historically accurate book that tells Anne's story through the eyes of the cat who was in hiding with them, who Peter, young Peter, brought into the secret annex. And as I said, it's completely historically accurate, but it inspired us to write a movie. The cat's name was Mushi, and Mushi really did exist. Anne wrote about Mushi several times in her diary. And we written a historical fiction piece that reimagines Mushi as a Dutch resistance fighter in an animal world. Kind of an Inglourious Basterds for kids.
Yeah,
And
fighting the Nazis, and the Nazis, of course, are symbolized or metaphorized as the German shepherds, Rottweilers, and pinschers that patrol the canal streets of wartime Amsterdam.
But of course, trying to make a movie that matters, which we love to do, in its simplicity, it, will educate about the Holocaust, about resistance. It will fight the hate that is out there right now. And we feel because it's just an action adventure, which, is really exciting, that it can really find a wide audience and make a difference.
Absolutely. Well, everyone, this has been wonderful. I'm your host, Steve Rubin. Our producer is Ben Shrewsbury. You've been watching Saturday Night at the Movies. Please feel free to subscribe. We're absolutely free. We're free entertainment. As you see, there were no commercials presented during this broadcast. No, none of us were harmed by those commercials.
How many is this?
I think this is our 104th podcast. So
Wow,
we're very excited.
congratulations.
Thanks, guys.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.